Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents How to Lose a War, the story of America's intervention in Afghanistan, by Amin Saikal. Narrated by Keval Shah. Preface. The Afghanistan conundrum has been haunting the country's population and the world for nearly five decades. During this period, five ideological clusters from different points of the political spectrum and two world powers have sought to transform the country into a viable state. Afghanistan has transitioned from a monarchy to a republic, to a People's Democratic Republic, to an Islamic Republic, to an Islamic Emirate, back to an Islamic Republic, and then back to an Islamic Emirate. The country has also been invaded and occupied by the Soviet Union in the 1980s and subjected to a US-led intervention for two decades from 2001, along with Pakistan's continuing interference. No country in the modern world has changed hands as many times in such a short period as Afghanistan. Ultimately, the country has entered its current darkest phase, for the second time, under the brutal religious rule of the ultra-extremist Taliban. The last hope for stability, security, and prosperity within a democratic framework came with the US intervention in response to the 9/11 Al-Qaeda terrorist attacks on America. But the US and allied involvement was confounded by a number of key issues. They prominently include America's inability to net its most wanted man, Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, sooner rather than later. Conflation of the Afghanistan campaign with the broader foreign policy goals of democracy promotion and war on terrorism. Poor governance by Afghan ruling elites under the US watch. And Pakistan's Janus-faced stance against terrorism, while promoting the erstwhile terrorist Taliban and their partners to undermine the US and allied campaign in Afghanistan, as well as Washington's strategy, or lack of it, in handling these variables against the backdrop of prevailing and historical complexities of Afghanistan and its region. This book explores the US-led intervention and its eventual failure within the framework of these variables, which have not received sufficient insightful attention. It narrates and discusses, critically, how the US's initial approach from a light footprint changed to a heavy footprint that widened and deepened its involvement in processes of state building and, by the same token, led it to fall into the Afghan trap, from which it could eventually extract itself only in defeat. The return to power of the Pakistan-backed and Al-Qaeda-linked Taliban in mid-August 2021 proved to be humiliating for the US, and indeed its allies, and disastrous for the people of Afghanistan. The United Nations warned in July 2023 that once again Afghanistan was at mortal risk of giving rise to terrorist actions. How long this phase of Afghanistan's turbulent evolution will last, and where it will lead as a source of tension and conflict in an increasingly polarized world, is now a matter of conjecture, as neither the Afghan people nor the world have seen the end of the Afghanistan crisis. In deciding to write this book, I was motivated by growing concerns that, despite the work that has been published on Afghanistan and the US-led intervention, some critical gaps exist in the literature. In its coverage, the book draws on years of my field work, interviews with Afghan, regional, and Western policymakers, practitioners, scholars, and informed folk, as well as my extensive writing and publications on the subject in regional and international contexts. The many people with whom I have had endless discussions and debates, inside and outside Afghanistan, about the failure of the American-led intervention, are too numerous to mention by name for a variety of reasons. Some, more specifically in the case of Afghan insiders, are still on active duty, while many others are in hiding or have joined the resistance. All of them know that I owe them enormous gratitude. 1. Introduction. Big Power, Small War. Afghanistan, a land of superb and rugged beauty, with a spirit which through the centuries has meant that the country has been unconquered and unconquerable. Richard Nixon. The former United States Vice President and subsequent President, Richard Nixon, made this remark when welcoming Afghan Prime Minister Mohammad Daoud on the occasion of his first official visit to Washington on 24th of June 1958. At that time, neither Nixon nor any American leaders could possibly imagine that one day the US would find it compelling to intervene in the unconquerable country and there fight the longest war in American history. Yet that day came shortly after Al-Qaeda's attack on the US on 11th of September 2001, hereafter referred to as 9/11, killing 2,977 people, plus 19 hijackers who, in a murder-suicide mission, slammed planes into New York's World Trade Center, the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., and a field in Pennsylvania. The event, comparable to Japan's strike on an American naval base at Pearl Harbor 60 years earlier, shook the world's most powerful state to its core. Backed by allies inside and outside the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, along with widespread global sympathy, the conservative Republican administration of the recently elected President George W. Bush launched a retaliatory military campaign within a month against Al-Qaeda and its protector, the Pakistan-backed Taliban ultra-extremist Islamic regime that had ruled most of Afghanistan since mid-1996. This marked the start of the Afghan War that the US, in President Bush's words, did not ask for and did not want, but which was imposed on it. However, this was also the war that in 2021, the US, and for that matter, NATO, lost after two decades of involvement, resulting in the return to power of Al-Qaeda-linked Taliban. It cast a long shadow over America's world power status and its fight against terrorism, changed the regional strategic texture in favor of the US's adversaries, and created titanic consequences for the people of Afghanistan. The question of where the US, and for that matter, its allies went wrong, has been widely debated. Different perspectives from varying ideological, geopolitical, and strategic vantage points have emerged in response. The central concern for this study is specifically to explore and expose those aspects of the US-led Afghanistan campaign that have not been addressed and analysed with the degree of insightfulness that they deserve. In a nutshell, the book focuses on what caused the US, along with its allies, to move from an initial light footprint approach to a heavy focus on state building, thus becoming entangled in a long war from which it could not extract itself in any other way than to make an embarrassing exit in defeat of the very original objectives of its invasion. It explores the fragility of the US-Afghanistan campaign in relation to Afghanistan's historical and prevailing intricacies, and the hunt for bin Laden and its conflation with America's wider foreign policy agenda of democracy promotion and war on terrorism, to preserve America's global power status that set the tone for the campaign from the outset. The failure to net the al-Qaeda leader, Osama bin Laden, and his main operatives early enough, to secure a reliable and effective Afghan leadership and workable system of governance, to halt Pakistan's predatory behavior, and to pursue an appropriately long-term military strategy to deal with unforeseen contingencies, could not but play a central role in derailing the American campaign. Sole world power status. The tragic events of 9/11 came at a particular juncture for the US in world politics. America's superpower rival, the Soviet Union, had disintegrated, and the Cold War as we knew it had ended a decade earlier. The US had claimed the triumph of democracy and free enterprise capitalism over Soviet communism and a socialist mode of development, elevating its own position as the world's sole superpower. These developments had emboldened the forces of the right in the US that had been seeking to shape America's foreign policy posture according to a unilateralist and ideologically and geopolitically assertive agenda since the Republican presidency of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. While held at bay during the Democratic administration of President Bill Clinton, 1993 to 2001, a major opportunity to advance American ideological and geopolitical objectives came with the advent of Bush's administration in January 2001. Three of the right's elements powerfully interlocked to dominate and determine American foreign policy priorities. First was the neoconservative group, led by such ideologues as Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Secretary of Defense, Richard Perle, Chairman of the Defense Policy Board Advisory Committee, and William Kristol, well-known writer and commentator. Second were the born-again Christian and evangelist movements, personified by President Bush himself. Third was the ultra-nationalist cohort, embodied by Vice President Dick Cheney and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Although hailing from different backgrounds, these minority forces shared a common ideological platform and belief in what can be termed a doctrine of power reality. The central point of their argument was that, as the mightiest state on earth, the US should exert its economic and military power to rebuff its adversaries and export American democracy, in the first instance, to the Middle East, and then to the rest of the world. They further contended, although for different reasons, that the US should stand behind the State of Israel as the most sacred and reliable Judeo-Christian and democratic ally in the Middle East. In a common cause, they advocated for regime change in oil-rich Iraq. Saddam Hussein's dictatorship was widely detested and demonized. It had functioned as a thorn in the side of the US since its August 1990 invasion of the Western-backed oil-wealthy Emirate of Kuwait, which the US, supported by a regional coalition, had successfully reversed 6 months later. Changing Iraq into a friendly democratic ally was to provide the US with a bridgehead to alter the political landscape against the hostile and defiant forces across the region, with one eager eye turned on Iran's Islamic fundamentalist regime. Iran was once a critical pillar of Pax Americana in the region. From 1953 until the Iranian Revolution of 1978-79 that toppled the pro-Western monarchy of Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, enabling the monarch's key religious political opponent, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, to transform the country into an Islamic republic and a hotbed of political Islamism. with an anti-US and anti-Israel posture. The higher goal of the three interlocking elements was to ensure the preservation and strengthening of the US position as the only global power, with the idea that the 21st century would be dominated by America, not any other power, particularly China, which was then in the process of emerging as a military and economic competitor. The Hainan Island Incident. An early sign of the Bush administration's assertive foreign policy posture became evident in the so-called Hainan Island Incident. On the 1st of April 2001, an air collision between a sophisticated US Navy spy plane and a Chinese jet fighter 80 kilometers southeast of China's Hainan Island forced the American plane to land in China with 24 crew on board. Beijing blamed the US for the episode over China's territorial waters, but Washington claimed that the Chinese jet was aggressively tailing the American plane in international airspace and demanded the immediate and unconditional release of the plane and its crew. The incident rapidly developed into an international crisis, Bush declared. Failure of the Chinese government to react promptly to our request for the return of the plane and its crew is inconsistent with the standard diplomatic practice and with the expressed desire of both our countries for better relations. After 11 days of tense deadlock and Washington's expression of regret over the loss of the pilot of the Chinese plane, Beijing released the American aircrew. However, the matter did not rest there. While China inspected the spy plane's state-of-the-art equipment and handed over its disassembled parts on 31st of July, Washington pursued a relentless policy of escalating pressure on China, condemning its human rights violations, and threatening to block its entry into the World Trade Organization. 2 weeks after the release of the American crew, Bush made a more explicit commitment than any of his predecessors to Taiwan's defense, declaring that if China attacked the island, the US would help Taiwan defend itself, whatever it took. This was despite the US having recognized China as the legitimate representative of the Chinese people and adopting a One China policy, with China replacing Taiwan as the permanent member of the United Nations UN Security Council in October 1971, reinforced by President Nixon's historic visit to China in February 1972. The US response to al-Qaeda's attacks. Thus, even before 9/11, the Bush administration's foreign policy had taken an upward trajectory in pursuit of building a US-centric world order. Al-Qaeda's mega-terrorist operation, which was designed to undermine the US's economic, military, and political power, and which killed mostly Americans, but also nationals from 90 other countries, constituted an unprecedented challenge that no American leader could brush off. Yet it also opened the arena for the Bush administration to cement America's post-Cold War global leadership. As Richard Clarke, the US counterterrorism czar, 1998-2003, reveals, for many years the American political, military, and intelligence establishments had been increasingly apprised of al-Qaeda and its founding leader, the wealthy anti-US Saudi Islamist dissident Osama bin Laden. The US had planned several times to target bin Laden. However, each time the plan had not been executed, largely due to risk-averse considerations, mainly at the instigation of the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA. Thus, Clark concludes that important opportunities were missed that could have prevented not only al-Qaeda's 9/11 attacks, but also several before it, on American targets in the second half of the 1990s. Al-Qaeda's enabler, the Taliban, emerged on the Afghanistan horizon from mid-1994, and assumed power 2 years later. While alert to the dangers of this group, Washington was cautious about taking decisive action against them as well. In the late 1990s, American diplomats based in the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad, along with policymakers in Washington, had engaged with some elements of the group for the purpose of information gathering and potentially inducing the militia to sever ties with al-Qaeda and cease sheltering bin Laden and his leadership team. Although the Taliban were happy to interface with US diplomats for recognition, they were not prepared to change their ultra-theocratic practices or agree to American requests to break their alliance with al-Qaeda, particularly given the personal bonds between the Taliban leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar, and bin Laden. In the process, Washington failed to act decisively against al-Qaeda's growing strength, with Ayman al-Zawahiri and his militant Egyptian Islamic Jihad joining the group shortly after September 2006. Al-Zawahiri rapidly emerged as bin Laden's lieutenant and al-Qaeda's main ideologue, and subsequently succeeded bin Laden following the latter's killing in a special US operation in 2011. The question confronting Washington over 9/11 was how to respond, given the breadth and width of the attack and its intended humiliation of the US. The Bush leadership had several options. One was to treat 9/11 as a criminal act and resource Interpol to hunt down its masterminds and bring them to justice, but not declare war. A leading advocate of this approach was Gore Vidal, an American writer, public intellectual, and strong critic of the Bush leadership. He argued, "Although every nation knows how, if it has the means and the will, to protect itself from thugs of the sort that brought us 9/11, war is not an option. Wars are for nations, not rootless gangs. You put a price on their heads and hunt them down." In recent years, Italy has been doing that with the Sicilian Mafia, and no one has yet suggested bombing Palermo. Vidal also regarded 9/11 as a colossal failure of US intelligence, a view echoed by many others, including Senator Richard Shelby, who, in a 2002 congressional hearing, called it an intelligence failure of unprecedented magnitude. This was especially so given the history of al-Qaeda's deadly attacks on American targets. Another option was to lean decisively on Pakistan to curtail all links with al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Washington was aware that Pakistan's military, or more specifically, its powerful inter-services intelligence, ISI, operated virtually as a government within a government, and that it orchestrated and supported the Taliban, facilitated the Taliban-Al-Qaeda alliance, and used radical Islamism as a foreign policy tool. If these groups could be prevented from using Pakistan's territory for cross-border movements into Afghanistan, it could force them to surrender at a time when Afghanistan's other neighbours had shunned the Taliban and closed their frontiers with the country. However, these two options were regarded as logistically very difficult to implement and were not conducive to the Bush administration's wider global agenda. The full support of Pakistan would have been needed for Interpol to penetrate Afghanistan deeply and pervasively to locate and capture al-Qaeda leaders and core operatives, who were strongly guarded by their own well-armed militia and Taliban protectors. Compelling Pakistan to disown the Taliban, and by implication their al-Qaeda allies, was not practical either, given Pakistan's heavy investment in the group. Although Islamabad publicly sided with the US against terrorism, President General Pervez Musharraf had already described Pakistan's support of the Taliban as a national security imperative for Islamabad. The third option that the Bush administration adopted was an intervention as the most effective way to achieve its Afghanistan-related and wider objectives. The initial plan was to pursue a light footprint approach and act in conjunction with the anti-Taliban resistance alliance of the United Islamic National Front for the Salvation of Afghanistan, UINFSA, to present the intervention as an indigenous-backed act of liberation. The convenient way to access Afghanistan was through the northeast border of the country with Tajikistan. This area was under the control of the UINFSA, which Islamabad had dubbed the Northern Alliance. The UINFSA had been organized and led by the Mujahideen commander Ahmed Shah Massoud, who had valiantly fought the Soviet occupation in the 1980s and opposed the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Massoud was assassinated by Taliban-backed Al-Qaeda agents 2 days before 9/11 as a prelude to the event. His fighters and supporters were therefore eager and willing to do whatever was necessary to see the end of what they generally regarded as Pakistan's proxy rule in Afghanistan. After the Taliban's rejection of US demands to hand over bin Laden, the Bush administration launched a military campaign, Operation Enduring Freedom, on 7th of October 2001. The top priority was to go after bin Laden by either capturing or killing him, and to destroy Al-Qaeda. But in the process, there was no choice but also to dismantle the Taliban regime and stabilize Afghanistan. Washington had not originally intended to fight a long and costly war in Afghanistan. It wanted to do only the bare minimum. It did not want to get involved in the difficult task of nation or state building, and thus potentially be led into a quagmire, as happened to the British and Soviets in the 19th and late 20th centuries, respectively. Deputy Secretary of Defense Wolfowitz, one of the leading architects of the US strategic planning for Afghanistan, made this very clear in a congressional hearing in June 2002. However, despite its early military success in dispersing Al-Qaeda and toppling the Taliban, but not defeating them, the US was confronted with a situation that led it into the so-called Afghan trap, just as the British and Soviets had experienced before. After 2 decades of very costly human and financial investment in state-building and military operations, with NATO and non-NATO allied input, the US found itself with little choice but to bow out of Afghanistan. It did so based on signing with the Taliban what was widely regarded as the flawed 29th of February 2020 peace agreement, formerly called the Agreement for Bringing Peace to Afghanistan. This agreement guaranteed a US and allied withdrawal, but not a political settlement of the Afghanistan conflict. It left the fate of the country in the hands of the vulnerable protege government in Kabul and its defense forces that the US and its allies had helped build at a very high price. As the foreign troop pullout accelerated, neither could survive the Taliban onslaught for even a few days beyond mid-August 2021, just short of the date designated by President Joe Biden to mark the 20th anniversary of 9/11. The Afghan armed and security forces, as well as the administrative apparatus, rapidly disintegrated, a lot sooner than President Ashraf Ghani had warned in January 2018. Saying that the Afghan National Army would not last more than 6 months without US support. However, the commander of US forces at the time, General John Nicholson, rejected this idea, claiming that the US could still win Washington's longest war. Ghani and his predecessor, Hamid Karzai, played their part in the process. In the end, while finding himself in the position of an emperor without clothes, Ghani broke his repeated promise to the Afghan people that he would never leave them. He fled the country, along with his close aides, completely losing his dignity. The cost and casualties of the war were less than those in Vietnam. But the humiliation that the US and its...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?